the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And it's been a great high-tech Christmas. Mm-hmm. I was giving out some Chromecasts. I didn't really ask for any technology toys this year.
You're all full up.
Well, here's the deal. If there's some little tech toy that I want, I just get it.
Right.
So when Christmas comes around, there's nothing else to give me.
I would imagine you're hard to buy for anyway.
I am, because I'm very, you know, persnickety over what I get. So so I didn't really ask for any tech toys, but I did give some Chromecast because I had a lot of family members that wanted to stream Netflix to this TV or that TV. And if you've got an old TV with an HDMI connection, you can always connect it to the internet and stream Netflix or stream Pandora. So it's a nice nice feature. And Chromecast is quite convenient. Some people like Apple TV, but that's $99. Chromecast is a little bit cheaper. You know, the reason it's called Chromecast, by the way, it was designed by Google, which of course produced the Chrome browser. And you take one tab of the Chrome browser and you click on the button and you can cast that window to the TV. So you were casting the Chrome browser to the TV, Chromecast. That's where the name came from. And then if you've got different iPhones or iPads, anything like that, all of the applications have a Chromecast functionality. You click on the Chromecast icon within that application and you can send it to the TV. So
neat.
It's a nice feature. I use it for the TV in the kitchen, and I kind of enjoy it. This week, we're going to talk about the guy who I call the unluckiest man in technology. This is a guy who really made a huge mistake that cost him $35 billion.
Wow.
And he ended up living in a trailer park in Pahrump, Nevada.
Oh, my gosh. Near Area 51.
Yeah, so you've got Pahrump, Nevada. There's not much there.
No, Area 51. That's where Area 51 is.
It is?
Yes.
I had no idea.
Well, let me see how close. But yeah, there is a famous radio host who lives in a trailer in Pahrump, Nevada, which I'm pretty sure. Let me see if I can find this now. But yeah.
No, but he moved to the Philippines.
He did. Oh, you know who I'm talking about.
I know who you're talking to. Yeah.
He did.
Coast to coast.
Coast to coast with Art Bell.
And he moved to the Philippines. So we're going to talk about this guy, the unluckiest man in tech. I'll tease that a little bit. You know, I'll talk a little bit about the, you know, technology disruption, some virtual stores, all these RFID vulnerabilities, genes that block out RFID signals. There's kind of a little problem with all of this. These RFID chips are in credit cards and passports and in security systems for buildings. And of course, we'll talk about the Sony hack and North Korea losing their internet. And it was a huge mailbag.
A letter in your mailbox.
Mr. Big Voices.
He came back from vacation or whatever.
Yeah, he's looking for.
You know what I'm trying to say.
No, I know. Mr. Big Voice is looking for a end of year bonus. I think you got to do more than just end of year performance to get an end of year bonus. It has to be through the whole year.
Exactly.
We got an email from Arnie in Crownsville. Hi, Dr. Schertz. Here's a follow-up to that Tor discussion that you had on Tech Talk a few programs ago. On December 22nd, the Tor Project blog sent out this message. The Tor Project has learned that there may be an attempt to incapacitate our network. In an email to the Tor Talk listserv, a user responsible for a group of nodes said that his network had been abruptly taken down over the weekend and that the chassis of one of the servers was opened up and someone put in a USB device 30 to 60 seconds before the connection was broken. He asserted this is similar to the protocol of sophisticated law enforcement officers who carry out a search and seizure of running servers. What do you think about these developments, Arnie, in Crownsville, Maryland? Well, let's talk about it. I'm going to have to have an aside here. Explain what Tor is.
Okay.
Tor stands for the Onion Router, T-O-R. And it is an array. It is a collection of proxy servers that are designed to allow people to surf the web anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
And to, you know, circumvent firewalls that may be blocking access to content. And what they do is they will basically refer you to maybe 6, 8, or 10 from one proxy server to another proxy server to another proxy server. And by the time you get out of this web of proxy servers, it's very hard to go back to the original IP address. And so it's autonomous. This was actually developed, this method of anonymous browsing was developed by the Naval Research Lab some years ago, and it was designed to help people in China or these countries with suppression to get the individuals there to be able to surf the web, to write on blogs, to be able to get around any firewalls that are blocking access to content and not being able to be tracked.
Mm.
So it was very good for that purpose, and it turned out to be a great little program. And other countries just hate it because it's very hard to break that encryption. NSA also, as it turns out, really doesn't like it either.
About that.
And so there have been a lot of attempts to break the Tor network. And so apparently what happened here, I don't know exactly who was doing it. Apparently some agency or someone who wanted to break the Tor network decided they wanted to get a list of all the Tor servers. So they took one of the servers in the network and they put in a USB and they started collecting data and they were going to use that data then to try to bring down the network. So that's what's going on, and people are worried about it, particularly if they want to remain anonymous. It turns out the Tor network in the U.S. was used for drug smuggling and all sorts of nefarious activities that the U.S. government would like to find out about. But the encryption is too good. So I think there are developments there, and it's hard to know who did the server break in, actually. But I think we could probably make a few guesses, but
sure. Nobody
really, really knows.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from Tung in Ohio.
Here we go.
Here we go again. Dear Tech Talk, my computer is getting old, and I'd like to upgrade. Should I get a desktop, a laptop, a tablet, or a hybrid? What kind of computer should I get? Love the show, Tung in Ohio. Well, I think she does a lot of computer work.
Yeah, she does a lot of computer work.
A lot of computer work, and she's, you know, her computer is probably getting quite worn with all that activity. Well, this is a very common question. People are so confused by how things have evolved. And so laptops are really great when you're traveling and when you really need what we call a real computer with, you know, like a keyboard and a display. And you could reasonably have a laptop as your only computer, you know. And if most of what you do is online, laptops have more than enough power to do that. The problem is laptops are typically more expensive than desktops, and they're difficult to upgrade. If you decide you want to upgrade it, add more capacity to it, you can't change the motherboard. Some laptops, you can't even upgrade the RAM. So they're not as upgradable as a desktop, but they certainly are very convenient. Now, desktops have the latest and greatest technology. They got powerful CPUs and all sorts of other components to make them faster because they don't have to worry about battery lifetime. So mm-hmm. they can have components that just suck up the power, and they don't care because there's no battery there. So, desktops are really, really, really useful. The other thing about desktops, you can have a big, big display. So if you're
when you're sending pictures and stuff like
you got videos. If you want to do edit videos, a big display. So these big displays could really be good for some of your applications. I would think. Also, if you've got a big screen, you could have multiple windows. So, I mean, at work, everybody's got desktops here on all of our IT department, a lot of our folks, so they'll have multiple monitors, multiple windows open, And it really increases productivity. So,
yes.
So you got sort of that sort of high productivity environment. A desktop certainly does make sense. Then you got the tablets. Now the tablets, of course, you can carry around with you. First of all, if you've got a tablet, you're locked into the ecosystem of either the Apple ecosystem or the Android ecosystem for applications. They're all application specific. And but the thing is, tablets are great for consuming content, but not creating it. So it's like great for emails, great for looking at websites, great for looking at videos, for reading books. But if you'd want to, say, write a long document with heavy formatting, it's tough to do it on a tablet. Even if you do get the new Microsoft Office running with Office 365 on there, it's still a kind of a pain to do it with the tablet, because you don't really have a standalone keyboard. And so I think that's probably not useful.
Well, the good thing about the tablet is a lot of them have cameras in them, so if she's interested in taking pictures and making movies.
The tablet is good, like, for Skyping and that sort of thing, if you want to do any sort of Skyping. I guess you could make movies with the tablet, too. That's true. Then, of course, the latest version out there is the hybrid device. This is what Microsoft has been pushing with the Surface, where you can basically separate the keyboard from the screen, and the screen is actually a touch screen. So it can turn into a tablet. Then you connect it back to the to the keyboard, and you've got what feels like a laptop. So it could either be a laptop or a tablet. So the hybrid devices are kind of interesting. Now they're just more expensive than a straight laptop or a tablet. So, like, what I do is I've got a Sony Vaio with a solid state drive, and that's the only computer I use. I got a solid state drive because I want to be super lightweight. I don't even have a DVD player in my unit because that just increased the weight.
Right.
And I hardly ever use a DVD player, so I bought a USB DVD, because sometimes there is, you want to place, you occasionally have to look at, people send you pictures or things on a CD or something, so I have a DVD that plugs into the USB port whenever I need it occasionally, but I don't have to haul that around with me when I travel. But the solid state drive, the problem with that, it's hard soldered into my laptop. So I've currently got 200 gigabytes or 250 gigabytes. I can't upgrade it. I can't get a bigger hard drive because it's just, if I want a bigger hard drive with that Sony Vaio, I just have to get a new laptop.
Right.
That's kind of one disadvantage of that one. Now, one thing that there is a trend that's going on with these. It used to be everybody in business had Windows. But I tell you, the Macintosh is beginning to get penetration in the business world. I went to my 10X CEO meeting down at, this is my peer CEO group. It's about eight other CEOs. I met them down in Florida last week. And so we all were sitting around the conference table. I had my Vaio machine with Windows on it. All other seven CEOs had MacBook Airs.
Wow.
And I'm thinking to myself, I'm kind of standing out here, Everybody else had a MacBook Air.
No, and it's funny because you use a lot of Apple stuff.
I know.
Otherwise.
Well, I've got the iPad and the iPhone.
Right.
So, I don't know,
maybe you should try that.
I never really wanted to be an Apple fanboy, but,
Neither did I, but you know what? You're the one that turned me on to Apple.
So I was thinking, I was looking around the table, and everybody was ridiculing my Windows machine.
I'm stunned. Tech boy is the butt of the joke.
I know. They say, well, maybe someday you'll wise
you'll
up.
You'll see the light.
So then you've got the choice if whether you're going to go to the Windows or the Apple ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And it really depends what kind of applications you're running. If you're more on the creative side, where you're making movies and all sorts of creative content, you want to come down on the Apple side. That's right. You never know what's going on in Ohio.
No, so. You know what? There's a lot more going on in Ohio than we think.
I know.
Is going
so
on
I
in
tried.
Ohio.
I tried to answer that as clearly as I could. We got an email from Lois in Kansas. Dear Tech Talk, my computer's been infected with malware. Lots of it. And I can't get rid of it all. I'm getting ready to throw this thing away. should I get a new computer? I'm just tired of trying to work on this thing. Nothing seems to clear out this mess. Thanks, Lois in Kansas. Well, Lois, you should never buy a new computer because of malware. Okay, well, I got to explain some very fundamental concept here. There's something called hardware, and there's something called software.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your computer's got the box, the power supply, the hard drives, the monitor, the CD-ROM. That's all hardware. They're physical things that you can see, touch, and feel. Now, the Windows operating system or the Mac operating system and your applications and your data and your pictures or anything else stored on your computer are actually software. They're just data. Now, malware is nothing more than software. Malware is nothing more than just more data stored on your computer. So it's just data that's been crafted to cause your computer to misbehave. And all data can be erased.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just restore your hardware to its virgin state, as they would say. So there are several approaches to removing hardware. One approach is to try to run the anti-malware tools and follow the instructions, and hopefully that would fix your problem. But it sounds like you've probably done that. You probably have something called a rootkit, which means that the malware can't really detect it easily, and it's hard to get rid of rootkits or something like that. And so if you're just fed up of trying to clean it, then your next option would be sort of the nuclear option. Well, your next which would be to do a clean install. So what you want to do is you want to back up all of your current hard drive to another machine or to an external hard drive. You might buy an external hard drive if you don't have it. You can probably get one for, you know, $50 or $60, not a big one. You can back up everything to an external hard drive or to another hard drive that you have around the house. Then once you've get, and why you want to back it up is that there's going to be data on that you're going to want to restore, you know, like, you know, your Word documents and other things. Then you're going to want to take and reformat your computer. This will erase everything from the hard drive, including the malware, gone. Then you'll reinstall Windows, clean install. You'll reinstall your applications from scratch. And then you'll restore your data from your backup or else you happen to wherever else you happen to store it. And then you've gotten rid of the malware. It's kind of a long process, but you can certainly do that. Now, there is one other way to do it. If you had, of course, backed up your hard drive in the first place. Like if you'd taken an image of your hard drive right after you got it right out of the box, you could simply restore to that virgin image, and then you wouldn't have to do all this reinstall stuff. That's why they highly recommend that you take an image of your hard drive as soon as you get a new computer, and you hold that aside, and you can always bring it back to the initial state just with one restore button. There is one other option that Windows has that you might try before you do the nuclear option, and that would be to go back to a prior set point. You know, your Windows system will actually it will actually save its configuration, and it will save itself at different set points. Like if you install something new, it will actually set a set point, and it will save the entire operating system at that set point. So you can restore from a set point or from a date prior to when you got the infestation. So that is possible. And on occasion, one time I let I let some people use my computer, and I came back, and it was just totally screwed up. I mean, that's why I'm so... I never did that again.
Yeah, I
never did that again. But then I just simply went back to a restore point prior to when they actually were on the computer, and I was able to just bring it back to the state that it was in.
Now, when you do that, when you restore to a previous date, mm-hmm. will that then purge the malware from the computer, or is it just hidden now?
No, it will restore it to now if the malware had been at that set point, if it was there at that time, it'll just restore it. But if there's malware there, it will basically override it, and mm-hmm. you can go back and undo whatever was done with the restore point.
Does it still reside on the computer, or
if there has been a subsequent saving, a subsequent set point since then? There could be malware saved on a subsequent set point. Yes, but you're restoring from a set point prior to when you got the install. But then, if you come back and go to a later set point after it got infected, you would just bring it back again. So it's still lurking in there, and so you just want to be careful what set point you use. Mm-hmm. So that's your option. That was a good question, yeah. Lois. And, you know, maybe you should just double check on who's been using your computer when you weren't around. We got an email from Craig in Oakton. Dear Tech Talk, what is the cloud? And how does it differ from the internet? I'm confused. Thanks, Craig and Oakton. Okay, this is actually, a lot of people talk about this. What's the cloud? It's like a buzzword now. Everybody mm-hmm. talks about the cloud. And actually, nobody knows what the cloud is. Okay, so I like to use the NIST definition. That's the National Institute of Science and Technology definition. Special publication 800-145. That is the official cloud definition for those of you who want to look it up. 800-145. Okay, cloud computing is a model that enables ubiquitous, you know, that's available all the time anywhere, convenient on-demand network access of shared configurable computer resources that can be rapidly provisioned and released with minimal management effort. So let me tell you what that means. See, in the old days, you just hook a server up to the internet, and people could go to that server. Now, suppose that on that server, you had, say, 1,000 users accessing it. Now, suppose tomorrow, 1 million users access that server. In the old days, a server would just die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that server were on the cloud, it would simply provision more resources dynamically to handle that surge in load without any human interaction. So the resources could be dynamically allocated on demand. And the resources can be located anywhere on the internet, just not in data center X. It can be data center Y, data center Z. So because you really don't know where the resources are located, they don't have a solid line between you and the server you're using. They have your line going to this thing that's drawn like a cloud. It's like it's sort of like a cloud, and you don't know where you're connected to resources within the cloud because they're dynamically reallocated. Mm-hmm. So these are the essential characteristics of cloud computing, according to the NIST circular 800-145. It has on-demand self-service. It has broadband access. It has resource pooling that allow multiple users to use the same resource. Rapid elasticity. It can scale larger on demand, and it has a measured service, so you can be billed for it. See, cloud services are typically billed. Yeah. So you have to bill for it. And so the service models are this: software as a service, SaaS. And so there are a lot of places that have software as a service, you know, like Oracle sells software as a service. Instead of say downloading a whole Oracle database, you can just buy Oracle services from Oracle as software as a service, and you just pay for what you use. And you got more users, fine. Just crank them in there. And Oracle will allocate more storage for you, and they'll just bill you for whatever you use. That's software as a service. Then you've got platform as a service. Now, what is a platform? Platform would be like a Windows computer. So suppose that all of a sudden you've got so many users that you need another Windows machine. So they'll just allocate another platform for you, and they just bill you for however many platforms you use as you dynamically load it. And the final one would be infrastructure as a service. These would be the routers and all the interconnects that support all of this. And so if you have a true cloud model, all three of these can be dynamically reallocated based on demand.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, I logged on. I was getting more cloud storage space from Google Drive. So I just went into Google Drive, and I just gave my credit card. I said, okay. I said, give me another 100 gigabytes of storage. I clicked. And 10 seconds later, they said, your 100 gigabytes of storage has been allocated. Now, no one came in there. No human came in there and did that allocation. It was all done dynamically. And so as more and more people ask for more storage, it's automatically allocated. That would be cloud. There are different deployment models. You've got the private cloud. This is like Stratford, we run all of our online stuff on a private cloud. We just use for us. We've got servers distributed around, and we allocate all of our online resources to a private cloud. You're going to have a community cloud where you might have, you know, Reston could have a cloud just allocated to them. You could have a public cloud like the Google Drive system. So that's it. That's cloud computing. It's not just connected to the internet. It's elastic connection to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. There's your definition of cloud computing, which I think comes up often enough that I thought I would just talk about it.
Like I said, it's kind of a ubiquitous term, and not a lot of people know exactly what it is.
No, and it's sort of a marketing kind of term. I mean, obviously,
it's a cute term,
mm-hmm. and then they draw this little cloud to show it, but it's like
makes you think it's off there in space somewhere.
But actually, I think the tech guys really don't like it, but yeah. You know, they'll put up with it, and especially if they can sell a cloud service.
You know, you do profiles in IT, and the developers come up with a name for something, and then the marketers come up with the name that sells it, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but everybody thinks they know about the cloud, but they don't have a clue what the cloud is. Mm-hmm. We got an email from Joe in Key Largo. Dear Tech Talk, I've been taking photos when I scuba dive, and the color seems to be shifted in the pictures. How can I get a better color correction? Thanks, Joe in Key Largo. Turns out I was scuba diving in Key Largo.
Go figure.
And my buddy, the buddy that they assigned me to was Joe. And so we were taking pictures together. And so Joe just sent me this email.
Oh, that's cool.
Because we got all these pictures that kind of look blue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, don't you hate it when you take these great pictures underwater and they all come to this kind of this blue-green kind of look? They just, they just don't look real. So it turns out when you're underwater, the longest wavelength is the first to be absorbed. So red, the longest wavelength. So red goes first, then orange goes, and then yellow. And as you go deeper and deeper and deeper, you just got getting more and more absorption. So you're going down to 50 feet, the red begins to go in. When I go down to 100 feet, it almost looks like I'm in a black and white movie. I don't see any color at 100 feet. So if you've got a very strong flash, you can actually bring the color back because you're bringing your own, a balanced color flash down there. But I was basically and Joe and I were taking pictures without much flash, and so we actually had the thing shifted. So here's how you can restore them. What you want to do is you want to use the channel mixer. Now, Photoshop has a channel mixer, and PaintShop Pro has a channel mixer. Now, you see there are three channels, red, green, and blue channels. And what you want to do is you want to take the imagery from the green and blue channels and add it into the red channel. You want to steal from the red, green, and blue channels and add it to the red channel. So you go to the channel mixer, and what you do, you select red out. You select the output channel red. And then because that's when you're going to want to change. And then you start sliding over the blue and the green, and you're going to play around with it. And you can until you get what you feel looks like a true rendition.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, it does a surprisingly good job. I was playing around with it this morning. Now I wasn't using Photoshop. I have PaintShop Pro at home because PaintShop Pro is like a poor man's Photoshop. It's like $50 or
right.
something. And so I had Corel's PaintShop Pro, in fact, had the channel mixer. And so you play around with it. Now, once you get the color set using the channel mixer, then you can adjust your mid-tone levels. You can start doing all the other kind of adjustments. Mid-tone levels, you can adjust hue, saturation, brightness, sharpening, and clarity, all the other stuff you want to do. But the main work is done with this channel mixer. And I'll tell you, it makes a big difference. So I was playing around with a few of the after Joe sent me this email, because what happened was I uploaded all the pictures to Dropbox after our dive, mm-hmm. so Joe could look at them, and I thought he'd be happy with it. And he said, what's wrong with the color? So Joe's like complaining a little bit. That's why I got this email.
Joe's gonna go fix them now.
No, I think I'm gonna fix them.
Oh,
and I'll fix them, and then I'll upload them to Dropbox, and then Joe will have. We'll have everything he wants in terms of those underwater photos.
No good deed.
I'll tell you, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll either talk about them on the air, or I might just email you back directly.
It is Saturday morning, and we're live on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. This is Tech Talk. Stand by. More of the show coming right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Woo, that was good.
You know,
But he's not going to get a bonus.
He got something for Christmas awakened him.
Today we're going to talk about Ronald Gerald Wayne. Ronald Gerald Wayne co-founded Apple Computer with Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
He had a 10% stake in the company, which he sold for a total of $2,300.
Wow.
It ultimately became worth $35 billion. So he is the unluckiest man in technology.
Sure sounds that way.
Ronald Gerald Wayne was born May 17th, 1934 in Cleveland, Ohio. Now, Wayne worked with Steve Jobs at Atari. And Wayne had tried to start his own companies. And Jobs was impressed with him because Wayne had actually started a company. And Steve Jobs wanted his expertise in starting this new venture. So April 1st, 1976, Jobs, Wozniak, and Wayne founded Apple Computer. You know, I didn't know that Apple Computer started on April Fool's Day, April 1st, 1976. They started Apple Computer. Now, Wayne actually wrote the partnership agreement. It wasn't a limited liability corporation. It wasn't an S-corp. It was a partnership. And this was the split. 45% went to Jobs, 45% to Wozniak, and 10% to Wayne. Now, at the time, Wayne was 43 years old, and Wozniak and Jobs were 22 and 23, respectively. Now, the way the partnership agreement read, all were personally liable for any debts incurred by the company.
Hmm.
But it turned out the only person who had any assets was Wayne. Because he was 43 years old, and he had accumulated. I think he started companies. He had assets. And of course, Jobs and Wozniak had nothing. So Wayne started thinking. He said, you know, if this goes down the toilet, I'm gonna be the one holding the bag. Now, they wanted him to serve as the venture's adult supervision. You see? Jobs and Wozniak were always, you know, like Jobs was sort of the marketing guy, Wozniak was a techie guy, and what happens if they just disagreed, and it'd be a 50-50? So what they did is they each had 45%, and then if there would be some disagreement, Wayne could come in, and he could side with one or the other, and he could break the tie. And so since he had business experience, which neither one of them had, they said, we need this guy to help us get our business going. So that's why they brought him in, and Jobs kind of liked Wayne. Now, Wayne drew the first Apple logo.
Really?
Yeah. So you can look it up. If you look him up, you'll see this. It was really ugly. But he wrote. He also wrote
Was that the Apple that had the different colors on it?
No, it was you look it up. If you look up Ronald Gerald Wayne, you'll see a picture of the Apple logo that he did. Now. He also wrote the Apple I manual. Now, 5 years earlier, he had started a slot machine company. And, you know, he had all these patents. He said, I'm gonna get rich. Because they're out, of course, Las Vegas. If you want to start a new company in Las Vegas, slot machines are going to be the way to go. So he started a slot machine company, and he went bust. He went bankrupt. So he started thinking, you know, I got these two guys here. You know, this thing just may go down the toilet in a few weeks, and then I'm gonna be liable for all this money. And he said, I just can't afford it. I just can't take the chance. So 2 weeks after he signed the partnership agreement for Apple, actually on April 12th, 1976, it was really only 11 days later,
jeez,
he decided to relinquish all of his stock in Apple because he said, you know, it's just too much risk.
Uh-huh.
So he got $800 for relinquishing his stock, $800, and he got back his stock. He said, phew, now I don't have to worry about this thing. If these guys go bust, I'm not going to lose a penny.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Wayne did feel that Apple might eventually be successful, but he thought there'd be a few bumps along the way, and he just couldn't risk it because of his prior experiences. Now, a year later, some VCs were trying to, you know, repackage, venture capitalists repackage Apple so they could get some money, and they looked at this buyout of Wayne, and they said, you know, maybe he might come back later on and say that you guys tricked him into this, and it really wouldn't hold. So they gave him another, they gave Wayne another $1,500, and then he forfeited any additional claims against Apple. That way they were sure that he couldn't come in and get that 10% back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that first year, Apple actually sold $176,000 worth of stuff. The next year, like $1 million. And it turned out by September of 2012, Apple had become the largest publicly traded corporation in the world by market capitalization, with an estimated value of $626 billion. Had he kept his 10% stock, it would have been worth $35 billion August 2011. Now, Wayne said he really doesn't regret selling his stock. Now, I just don't believe that.
No.
Wayne, I do not believe that. Now, he said he made the best decision possible with the information available at the time. I don't think so. I mean, he said, I just felt I was too old to keep up with these two whippersnappers. It was like holding a tiger by the tail. Now, Wayne resisted Jobs' attempts to get him to return to Apple, and he stayed at Atari until 1978. Then he left Atari. He joined Lawrence Livermore Labs, and then later he joined some electronics company in Salinas, California. Now, Wayne also ran a stamp shop, because he loved collecting stamps. He ran a stamp shop in Milpitas, California. How do you think? Milpitas, California. How would you pronounce that?
I think that's how I do that.
Milpitas, California. Never really heard of that before. He ran a stamp shop.
Google Maps.
Would you just?
I'm gonna find that.
Yeah, you get Google Voice to, you know, maybe get Siri or somebody to
working
pronounce
on
that for us.
We're
thank
working
you.
On it.
So he ran a stamp shop in Milpitas, California for a short time in the late 70s. But he had a number of break-ins while he was there. And finally he said, to heck with this place, I'm moving to Nevada. So he moved to Pahrump.
There's a plan.
He moved to Pahrump, Nevada, which now I know is where Area 51 is.
Yes, it is. You learned something. You learned something from me. Milpitas is north of San Jose.
Yeah, it's close to Silicon Valley, north of San Jose. So he's now retired, and he's living a quiet lifestyle in Pahrump, Nevada. He lives in a mobile home park, and he still sells stamps and rare coins. That's how he earns money.
Mm-hmm.
He holds a dozen patents, mostly related to slot machines. He did not own an Apple product until 2011, when he was given an iPad 2.
What?
Until 2011.
How'd that happen?
He was just sort of in isolation out there in Pahrump, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
He published the book Adventures of an Apple Founder in July of 2011. That's probably when he was given that iPad, too. He was trying to, you know, capture his thing. Also, the original partnership agreement he put up on eBay and sold it for like $3,500 or something. He also wrote another book, Insolence of Office, which is a socioeconomic treatise talking about the sort of the origin of our constitutional system and governance in America. And that was published October 1st, 2011. Now, when you read the Wayne came out as being gay to jobs shortly around February of 1974 while they both worked at Atari. Now, this was actually something that was in Steve Jobs' biography. Steve Jobs told his biographer that this was the first encounter that he'd ever had with anybody who he knew was gay. And actually, you know, Steve Jobs said he still liked working with Wayne. It didn't have any effect on him, but he never really knew anybody that actually at that time confirmed that they were gay, because you had to, it was like don't ask, don't tell kind of thing back then. Now, Wayne remembers Steve Jobs as being colder than an ice cube, who could be ruthless at times.
Wow.
So I would say that the admiration is not mutual.
No, it doesn't sound like
and
it.
And I'd say that Ronald Gerald Wayne, as his mother would call him, was probably probably unhappy that the fact he sold his 10% stake in Apple.
Okay, a couple of things. I saw the original Apple logo. It's horrible. It looks like it should be on a bottle of apple juice is what it should be.
It's like a carved thing of an apple tree with an apple falling
off. Somebody made it at wood shop or something.
It's like it looks like Garden of Eden and an apple dropping off a tree or something.
Exactly.
It is just really ugly.
Let's see what our friend Forvo has to say. This comes from the pronunciation is from Frank from Virginia. Let's see if Frank gets this
Milpitas.
Milpitas. Okay, well, I got that one wrong.
You got that one right.
I said Milpitas, I thought. Oh, so it's Milpitas.
Okay. And we were both wrong.
Okay.
So, Frank, how was that again?
Milpitas.
Okay, there we go.
Okay, thank you, Frank.
Uh-huh.
You know,
well, you know, we're lucky. We have all of these people that help us out there.
I hope we're not going to have to pay him because he's not in the budget.
No.
Okay.
I think, you know, it's a holiday weekend. It's just going to slide right under the radar there.
Okay, very good.
You know, this is Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HT2. Hope you are paying attention and you're not suffering from eggnog overload, because we're going to have the pop quiz coming up and your chance to win a free prize. Well, all prizes are free. Are they? I don't know. But it's a good prize. Stand by the top. Whatever. This is Tech Talk Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to Classroom of the Airways.
Mm-hmm.
Those of you who might have been thinking you were listening to a radio show, but
you were wrong.
Mm-hmm. This is Classroom of the Airways, run by Stratford University. And of course, when there's a classroom, we must assess the learning outcomes. And we do that with a pop quiz.
Indeed.
Yes, if you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, you will get an A+ for this session, but you will also win two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room, the Karem Dining Room. Now, earlier in the show, I was talking about Ronald Gerald Wayne. He, of course, helped Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak found the original Apple computer. Where were Ronald Gerald Wayne and Steve Jobs working when they first met?
Mm-hmm.
If you get the right answer to that, you'll win these tickets to fine dining. Now, you just have to communicate that to us. Now, how might they do that, Jim?
Well, if you're calling from west of the Rockies, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east to Pahrump, Nevada, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. But wait, there are other options, I'm
sure. Yes, if you're calling from North Korea and you want to have an encrypted phone call, simply connect to us on Skype. And connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and your call will be forwarded directly to the studio free of charge, and the entire call will be encrypted.
Wouldn't you have to have the internet to do that, though?
Oh, yeah, but the internet...
They got it back, right?
They've got the internet back.
Okay, good for them.
Yeah, they got the internet back. Well, let's talk about the dangers of RFID signals.
Mm-hmm.
This is radio frequency ID signals, and of course...
I didn't know there were dangers.
There are dangers because, you see, you can actually ping these RFID chips and they talk back to you, and people are able to get information from them.
No kidding.
Like, for instance, people have an RFID chip for, like, building security systems.
Right.
Well, you can build a little, in your briefcase, a device that will actually ping RFID chips around, and you can just walk near someone. And you can actually pull the data right out of their RFID chip, and you can make a bogus RFID chip, and you can get into the building.
That's not cool.
There are also cases where people have been able to do this with credit cards, where they're not putting these chips in credit cards,
right.
Wireless chips in credit cards. You can actually ping them and get information out of the credit card. Now it's only good for one transaction, and then you have to ping it again, but. So this is there's also a problem. There's an RFID chip in U.S. passports. So people were worried that there would be terrorists that might, say, be somebody's walking down the street and they just wait for a RFID response from a U.S. passport and it just triggers some kind of device. So all of those things considered, people said, maybe I should try to shield my RFID chip. So you could wrap everything in tinfoil. That's one way to do it. But,
or just stay in your underground bunker complex.
You can stay in your underground bunker complex. Now, or you could buy jeans that block wireless signals.
Why not? I'm sure they're very stylish, too.
And so there have been a pair of jeans. This has been developed in conjunction with the antivirus for Norton. Now, these trousers are intended to stop thieves from hacking your radio frequency identification, tagged passports, or contactless payment cards. Now, the jeans were designed by the online clothing company Beta Brand, and use a silver-based material to block signals. Yeah, MLPs. Now, they're going to go on sale in February. Now, the jeans only cost $151.
It's a bargain.
For $198.
And I'm sure that's stylish,
now,
too.
Now, Disc Labs is also using a similar technology to make a wallet, which, like Beta Brand's jeans, it blocks RFID signals.
Okay.
So... this is available. And in fact, I have to say, this Christmas, I forget who
got... You got Beta Brand jeans?
No. Somebody got this Christmas, I think Marianne got a wallet with RFID blocking technology in it.
Do they also block the harmful powers of kryptonite?
No, they don't.
Okay.
They don't do that at all. So this is just another thing to worry about. And that is the duty here in Tech Talk.
Just to make you worry more.
To raise anxiety level up for everybody, out there in Washington.
Well, there you go.
That's right.
I'm going to become the local distributor for Beta Brand jeans.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, all right. I may mark them up, too. Hey, let's go to the phones, and this is line numero uno, and James calling from, bear with me, I think he's in Catonsville. Yes, Catonsville,
yes.
Maryland. How are you?
Catonsville, Maryland.
James, how are you, sir?
Guys, I really love this show that you have. And I'm so glad I was listening right down the Beltway.
We were, too. We're glad.
Yeah, and I believe the answer was Atari.
Yes.
That is correct.
We're a little out of order, but
we don't even have to ask the question.
No.
We have such an on-the-ball.
Oh, I'm so embarrassed.
No, that's okay. We're running late on time anyway, so
that's
you saved
right.
So, Doc... Tell him what he's won.
You're going to win two tickets to fine dining, the Scoffier Dining Room, the Karim Dining Room. Just stay on the line and give your contact information to our producer, Andrew.
Yes, indeed. And thank you so much. I'm going to put you on hold right now because my brain is not working too well. This is Tech Talk Radio. You're listening on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. Yet more of Tech Talk Radio and more talk of Milpitas, California, coming up in just mere moments.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology.
Which is not located near Area 51.
No, not anywhere close to Area 51. We also don't have any campuses in Area 51 either.
I'm telling you, we need to take Tech Talk on the road and go to Area 51 and visit the atomic testing museum, which is in Pahrump, Nevada.
Near Pahrump, Nevada. Yeah. Okay, that's very good.
But I'm probably going to have to keep you away from Area 51 Entertainment.
That's right. We got to stay away from that. Yeah. That's for sure.
That could be problematic.
Okay, this is the thing. You've heard about this Sony hack, you know, there's this massive hack of all the Sony content, the emails, and a lot of their videos. The Sony hack was probably an inside job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not what's been not what you've not been hearing so much on the news, but a lot of security firms have been looking at. So many experts in the U.S. are skeptical of the FBI's claim that North Korea is responsible. Instead of blaming North Korea for the hack, cybersecurity firm Norse, based in California, believes the hack was actually an inside job led by a former Sony employee named Lena. Lena. On Wednesday, a senior vice president at the Norse firm, Kurt Stamberger, told CBS News that the firm's investigation has led them to believe that the Sony hack was so devastating that it could only have been accomplished by someone who really knew the whole architecture of the system and some key passwords. We're confident that the hack was not masterminded by North Korea. Stamberger identified the main hacker as a woman who calls herself Lena, claims she's connected to Guardians of Peace.
What now, in the world is that?
I know. Guardians of Peace. Now, many like to call them the GOP.
Oh, okay.
But I prefer Guardians of Peace.
All right.
This was, and she was a Sony employee for 10.
I'm buying you a ticket to Area 51 one way.
She was a Sony employee for 10 years, and she left May 2014. The woman, according to Stamberger, was in the right position, had deep technical knowledge, and she could locate the specific servers that were compromised. Now, technical analysis of the data deletion malware used in the attack revealed links to other malware that the FBI knows North Korean actors previously developed. For example, there were similarities in the lines of code, encryption algorithm, data deletion methods, and compromised networks. The FBI observed significant overlap between the infrastructure used for this attack and other malicious fiber activity in the U.S. government that had previously been linked to North Korea. However, you can spoof IP addresses. So you don't really know where it's being originated from. And Stamberger contested these claims, saying that many of the clues that were leading in that direction, such as the malware used to the attack, have been seen before and could easily been used by almost anyone. And in fact, that same malware is used worldwide on a daily basis by hackers all over the place. It was just so malware sort of is like share and use and reuse. So that North Korean fingerprint was not necessarily an indictment that they had actually been using it. Now, a further clue was that the actual initial request by the hackers, they wanted a monetary payment for this information, and Sony refused to give them a monetary payment. So when they couldn't get the monetary payment, they just released stuff, and then they just went with the flow that it was Korean. And then they said, okay, we don't want you to post that movie. So many people feel, and this is not just one security firm. There are multiple security firms that have come to the same conclusion. So I think that's an interesting angle on this whole Sony deal. And it is very also quite logical that it would be that way, because most corporate hacks actually originate from the inside. That's actually your weakest link, as you know, a former employee, and that's very, very common. So then we'll ask, okay, what happened to North Korea? Their internet went down. Was there some sort of big reprisal against North Korea? So now let's look at that internet going down in North Korea. Now, North Korea internet went dark for 9 hours on December 22nd, and it was experiencing intermediate outages the next day. Now, many people believe this was a distributed denial of service attack, and it makes a lot of sense. People analyzed the data, and they said, yeah, it looks like this has the imprint of a denial of service attack. This is where you just flood a particular location with a lot of traffic, and you overwhelm them so they can't really respond, and then you deny service to other people because the servers are overwhelmed. It turns out that the internet access of North Korea is fairly, fairly meager. They have a connection to the internet, which is only 3 gigabits per second. 3 gigabits per second is the pipe that connects North Korea to the rest of the internet. Now, you remember last year there was a distributed denial of service attack against Spam House. Mm-hmm. Spam House was brought down with 300 gigabits per second, 100 times more data. And the Spam House attack was initiated by a teenager, one person. So it would be very easy for one person to bring down the entire North Korean traffic without any problems at all.
So it wasn't necessarily us.
So it wasn't necessarily us. And many people feel it was just probably somebody thought they could do it, so why not do it? So that's really the deal. And so it could have been some teenage joker. It could even been a clandestine hire of Sony Pictures. Maybe they brought it down. But it was relatively easy to bring down. So I don't believe that the U.S. government did it at all.
So how does this make the U.S. government look? Because the U.S. government is pinning all this on North Korea.
I think they just jumped on that bandwagon a little too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they just need to retrace it a bit and just be... I don't really like North Korea. But I think in this instance, they were probably innocent. Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. And also, check out Stratford University programs by going to stratford.edu and tell them that you heard about them on Tech Talk Radio.
If you indeed tuned in later would like to hear this program again in its entirety, it'll rebroadcast again today at 3 o'clock here on Federal News Radio. We'll see you next week.
Commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio on the air at 1500 AM. a.m. and online at federalnewsradio.com, the only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and federalnewsradio.com.
Sports on the air today. We got Caps hockey beginning at 7:30 tonight. Sunny and 60 today. It is 45 outside our studios at 10 a.m.